Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai, supporting the drive to keep our distance. chse.ie for more.
Good morning and you're very welcome to the show. And I would have to say that on this bank holiday Sunday morning, there is one theme across the front of the papers that almost feels like an unstoppable momentum at this stage. Driven in the main, it has to be said, well, driven a lot by Fianna Fáil, but also, it would have to be said, from what we can see, out of touch with what a lot of the public think. So the Irish Mail on Sunday, Micheál Martin will speed up the lockdown exit. He believes a programme for government can be agreed this week, and one of the first tasks of the new coalition will be to accelerate the lifting of restrictions around COVID-19. They're talking about travel restrictions be lifted at the earlier date of June 29th. And there's an interview inside Micheál Martin. His other concerns are childcare, education for kids with special needs and SMEs, among other things. The Sunday Independent has a picture of two poor guards having to go up and confront young lads who were jumping off the Blackrock diving tower in Salt Hill. I suppose you would say they are congregating. They don't quite make up a horde, but they are definitely congregating, and the guards are having to go up and be killjoys there. So they're saying move to scrap travel limits from June 29th to save the summer. And that is the message being driven by Jim O'Callaghan, certainly. I think we need to set the end of June as our goal for the restrictions to be lifted, he's saying. So clearly the view there is that the summer needs to start at the start of July. So they're talking about scrapping limits on how far people can travel from home 3 weeks early. Museums, galleries, hairdressers and other amenities could be reopened by the end of June. Hotels allowed to operate with limited occupancies subject to the spread of COVID-19 remaining suppressed. So a new 20-kilometre limit from tomorrow week, but that might be allowed to expire on June 29th. Fianna Fáil now believes there's no logic or scientific basis for the 5 kilometre or 20 kilometre limits. They do put in the caveat there that all these decisions will be guided by data. The Sunday Times, tourists could face COVID tests at Irish airports. So that is this slightly controversial 14-day quarantine for tourists and business travellers entering Ireland. Brendan Griffin, the junior tourism minister, is saying that they're looking at if they could get rapid result COVID-19 tests at airports to screen tourists. Micheál Martin is here again. He has back calls from restaurateurs and hoteliers. Now, listen to this. For cafes and restaurants to be allowed to reopen on June the 8th, instead of June 29th, to allow hotels to admit overnight guests from June 19th instead of July 20th. Business Post, Cabinet to ease some COVID-19 restrictions amid growing pressure. The Business Post, not as sweeping with it. They do point out that the government is holding firm on the 2 metre social distancing and holding firm on the 14-day quarantine. But they are looking at scrapping the 20-kilometre limit is going to be discussed. Nursing home visiting restrictions. Elite athletes expected to be given permission to resume training. We've seen, I don't know if you saw on RT News during the week, elite athletes who are all training at home with all kinds of homemade kind of setups. Leo Varadkar has privately warned ministers to stop questioning the 2 metre social distancing limit. Micheál Martin again here saying that he wants foreign travel. He likes the idea of groups and corridors developing between countries where there are low rates of the virus manifesting. But here is the rub in all of this. The Business Post have a Red Sea poll today. 66%, two-thirds of people, are happy with the current government roadmap for reopening businesses and social activity. So a third of people, yes, unhappy, and that's growing, but two-thirds quite happy with the way things are. The Sunday World has its lead story is about the Penguin Files, and that's about George the Penguin Mitchell, and they have lots of detail in there about surveillance on him. Also, Eugene Maston has a great story on page 2. The Goat pub set up a little van outside selling pints, and obviously you got hordes and you got congregating and all the things we're not supposed to do. So I think they had to shut down that. There are reports I've heard of, I think what they call them in America is tailgate parties, where people are parking in big car parks around pubs and having parties in their cars, getting their pints out to them. And the Sun and the Sunday Mirror both leading on a story about Ivor Callaly. Now, our panel today is former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern, Nora Casey, broadcaster and publisher, and Diarmaid Ferger, professor of modern Irish history in UCD. Good morning, everyone, and you're all very welcome. We are all socially distanced. We constitute four people from four different households, so this is a permitted gathering, so we'll proceed. Bertie Ahern, do you agree that we should be loosening up faster?
I think we have to be careful. A few points. One, throughout the months, I've watched Tony Hoolan and his team, and I think they've been very good at going in front of the media, answering the questions, explaining themselves, trying to lead the country in a particular way. And as your poll shows, 2/3 of the people agree with them. I think that's probably declining, particularly in a day where it's 23 or 24 degrees. But the rules haven't changed. I was watching the UK press conference last night. You know, there's still huge numbers dying in the UK. Probably about 250 will die, you know, today in the UK again. So I think the data regarding the progression of the disease, the capacity of the health service, the testing, and
I would argue, Bertie, that we do meet all those criteria.
But I think
our testing and tracing is months ahead of the UK.
Yeah, I think we have to stick with those things. But if you ask me, so I think we have to give credit for what the leadership we're getting from Tony Hoolan and not just all of a sudden decide on a Sunday morning that it's all gone.
Yeah.
So I think that would be very unfair. And to all the frontline workers, from, you know, the people in hospitals, but the supermarkets, the people who run in the internet banking services and the banks, all the people who've worked.
Delivering our posts.
All of those people have been terrific. So I don't think we can just jump over. Now, the other side of it, if you tell me stage five is the 10th of August, 2 weeks before the schools and colleges go back, when the summer is over. I know in West Kerry people start abandoning at the end of August, the holidays or schools go back in the last week of August, that's going to be stage five. And we're going to have to wait to stage five. I think that's too long. I think tomorrow's the 1st of June. 50 days brings you up to the 20th of July. And that to me seems like a fair period. So rather than just abandoning everything, I would like to see stage five abandoned, and that you start progressively bring things forward. But okay, the 20th of July is long enough.
What Jim O'Callaghan seems to be saying and what Micheál Martin seems to be on board with, that we look at by the end of June. You think that's too early?
I don't think that's going to happen. I've listened to what the Taoiseach has been saying. I've listened to what the Minister of Health is saying. I listened, more importantly, maybe, is the public health advice. And, you know, I just think the end of June, I'd love it to be the end of June. And I feel really sorry for all the little cafes. Like in my own area, I went out and about yesterday because it was on today, and I was talking to various people that I know for donkey's years, and they are struggling. They're paying their rents. They're only taking in a few bucks. And they're really, really struggling. They can't continue on much longer. None of them seem to have got off the rents. People who are trying to open up, the hotels are still closed, the restaurants are still closed. They're doing okay, by the way, on the Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, delivering at home. That's become quite a big business. One restaurant I know very well is delivering more meals on a Friday night and Saturday night now than they have places in the hotel. So it's not all... it's not all doomsday, though there is a lot of doomsday. So I think you will not carry the public if we drift into August. You will ruin the tourist season entirely if you drift into August. But I don't think you can just abandon it all.
You think August could in some way save the season and in some way kind of give us some bit of a summer?
I think the fourth lockdown has to open up. And if that doesn't open up, I think the season is gone. And that's just, that will kill a huge part of the tourist industry. And remember, Brendan, there's 500,000 people tied up in the bars, restaurant, tourist season in this country.
Yeah.
And if you I know about the health, but if you're balanced economic, I think at that half a million, the people who are on low money, you know, struggling on the season, and they need that. So that's a half a million workers.
Can you see the bars coming back? Like, bars seem like a thing that's going to be a particular problem. And the more we know about this, about enclosed spaces, crowds of people, loud talking, these are all the things that seem to speak into a pub, and they're all the things we don't want.
Bars and gyms, I'm afraid, two things I like. But bars and gyms, I think, are in trouble. Because even if you bring it down to the 1 metre rule, but still, I still think the end of July, I think 50 days from tomorrow, if we follow all the other rules, seems like long enough. I think drifting into August is, well, I think you lose the public. I think your figures on the 66% won't be that way. And so much good work has been done. And it's not that much. I mean, like New Zealand, we have the thing about churches. Today is Pentecost Sunday, right? All our churches are closed in the country. New Zealand 2 weeks ago went to 100 in the church, 100 for funerals. Like, I mean, there's some things that I don't know why we're so conservative on.
You think we should let the churches back more?
Yeah, 100 people. I mean, we're doing that in New Zealand.
New Zealand have pretty much eliminated it.
They have, but I think 100 people in the church that holds 1,500.
Yeah.
You know, to be honest, which I was in the supermarket the other night, which is smaller than the local church, and there was about 100 people in the supermarket, but only 10 in the church. I mean, I don't get that.
Okay. Nora Casey, what do you think? Should we be opening up faster?
I think from the beginning, there's been this unfortunate phrase called trade-off, which it really looks at the economic benefits rather than the public health difficulties. And I'm not a fan of it. And I don't think that many SME owners are either. I think if your house is on fire, you put the fire out first and then you start rebuilding it. So all of the research from the last SARS epidemic showed that people who had stringent measures to reopen actually recovered their economies quicker. So for me, all the benefits, I always felt that would this lead to lasting change? It's probably directly compared to how long we've had the lockdown as to whether we change at all. Within a few weeks, we'd have all have gone back to what we did before. So now we're trying to rush the reopening. Your statistics are exactly right. Every single restaurant
that's
that has contacted
from the business post, but I should say that's their poll.
I would say that's replicated in small business owners who are contacting me, who are surveying their own customers. About a third say, I never believed in COVID, by the way, don't care about it, I'm not in the target group, I'll be back to you as soon as you're open. There's a good third, big fat third, that say, if you make your environment safe, I'll come back. If I feel safe in your hairdresser or your bar or your restaurant, I'll be there. And then there's a third that say, I don't care what happens, until there's a vaccine, I'm not going back into your premises. So that's replicated, I think, in people's feelings around the country. So just because one group shouts loudest doesn't mean it's right. For me, if we start to reopen everything very quickly, we miss the whole benefit of this. You know,
so
we've
you
a congested.
Stick with the roadmap as is.
I don't think it's about dates. I really don't think. I think it's about the same way that we have concentrated almost daily on public health issues. We now need to put a significant concentration on what could this mean for the future of the country. Do we have to have 200,000 people commuting every day? Do we have to use big buildings?
We'll come to those bigger pictures. Ciara Kelly in the Sunday Independent today says that we have taken a baseball bat to our way of life and to our economy and how we live and everything else. And she points out that I think outside of people who should be cocooning, 165 or so people, that's under the age of 65 or not with an underlying condition, have died. Does she have a point?
Well, it's certainly true. For instance, when it comes to cancer, somebody dies every hour. If we had a poll every night announcing the deaths in Ireland from non-COVID related issues, you know, we'd have significant numbers that we were sharing. That does not mean that the lockdown wasn't right. I'm of the view, we don't have Jacinda Ardern in Ireland, and she's an amazing woman and a great leader in New Zealand, and she did things the right way from the very beginning. But we have been swift and we have been effective, and the tsunami we predicted didn't happen, but that doesn't mean it wasn't the right decision to start with.
But the one thing I would say to you,
I have a mum who's 89. She's probably listening and going to murder me and all of you now for saying that. But nonetheless, I took all the right steps to make sure that she was well supported in her decision to cocoon. It was advisory. It was her decision. But, you know, if you look at why people are beginning to question the roadmap, because they've discovered that nearly 63% of people died in nursing homes, a significant other majority died in meat processing plants. So people out there in the community, you know, who are talking to me are saying, what are they talking about us and us social distancing and all the rules and, you know, the nth degree of who we should be next to in the 200 metres versus the 100 metres? Why are they saying all of that?
I think there is a slightly dangerous view out there that, I think, in fairness, Tony Houlihan said it last week. He said it was extinguishing the community, and I think it did make people a little bit reckless. What do you think, Dermot Ferriter?
It was huge relief for people to hear that it's virtually extinguished, you know, but there's still great fragility there. And you asked at the beginning about this clamour, is this unstoppable? Yes, it is. It is stoppable for the very simple reason the narrative could change very dramatically in the next couple of days. You know, if you see figures going in the wrong direction, that'll force a complete reassessment. And then this question of public health advice and the scientific evidence will come to the fore once again. So talk of what'll happen in July and August will, I think, quickly become quite redundant. I do think people need dates, you know, in the sense that you do want to give people some kind of roadmap. You do want to bring people along. Obviously, there's been a very centralised approach to the management of this, which made sense in an emergency. But the question is now about the relentless lobbying that will go on from different sectors for different areas to open up. One thing that's missing, I think, is a focus on education. There is a strong case to be made for some partial return of primary school kids in June.
And Pat Spillane is making that point.
Well, I mean, Luke O'Neill is making the point.
I think Luke O'Neill says today that there's no excuse.
There is no scientific basis for keeping kids out of primary school. And we're not talking, you know, about a return to normality. But if you don't have that, you'll have a situation where primary school kids would have been out from mid-March up to September. And that's problematic for all sorts of reasons. Now, people are, of course, going to begin an a la carte approach to the rules and regulations. I was out in Seapoint during the week and it was quite clear. I was there on Thursday afternoon.
This is a beach near Monkstown in Dublin.
Yeah, I mean, Seapoint in Dublin, I mean, obviously a very famous bathing spot and very popular with young groups in particular, you know. And there was a big sign, a flashing sign up saying swim and go. I mean, it might as well have been under the water, that sign, you know, such as the disregard for it. And you can understand if people are hearing on the one hand that there's virtually no COVID out there in the community and it's very, very hot, they're going to want to jump into the water. But it wasn't a question of people swimming and going. It was a question of people, some people staying there for hours on end. And the crankier older people, of course, were saying, well, are they going to, is their behaviour going to result in Seapoint being closed off again? You know, and you can see that photograph there in relation to Salt Hill in Galway. So those situations are going to arise. But it wouldn't take
much. So what's the answer to that? Do we need to be a bit more of a police state? Does there need to be harder policing on all this stuff?
Well, we are already. I mean, I'm sure I'm not alone in experiencing such visibility for policing and the amount of stops on the road. There was a suggestion they might switch their focus from the roads to places where people are gathering. There is a huge visibility there. There's also an awful lot of people who are exercising responsibility, let's be fair. But this question of an unstoppable clamour, yes, you could make an argument, given how things have been handled to date, that we don't need the most severe lockdown anywhere. And we don't need the slowest return to whatever we're returning to. But at the same time, you know, we are going to have to face the figures as they transpire over the next couple of weeks and be guided by them.
And I think the caveat is there, in fairness, in all of that, that, you know, depending on the figures. Bertie Ahern, would you have handled all this any differently?
I don't think so. I think the government have done a good job.
Do you?
Frankly,
yeah.
I do. I think, honestly, I think Tony Houlihan and his team have done a good job. I great admiration for the man. There's been lots of problems on the way, and I think I look at those as things we should learn. I think we made a hames of leaving the Italians in when there was no match. They were all over Drumcondra that weekend. It was crazy. It was equally crazy to send 50,000 to Cheltenham.
Yeah.
The PPE equipment thing was all over the place for a while. You know, the Leaving Cert, I have my own views on it. But
go on, what are your views?
Well, I have to say I still think Leaving Cert wasn't to start till next Wednesday. And I still think we should have had it.
We could have had it starting next week.
In my own school, there's the primary school of a huge hall and the secondary school of a huge hall. For the amount of people that would have been in it, for all the trouble that that caused.
Then you definitely think we could have had it at the end of July, yeah? When they had moved it out.
But what do you think happened?
But it's not gone for a lot of people. It's a huge... These kids are still... A lot of them will suffer because of
this
system.
Well, they've signed up to a new system, but I think it... Like, the idea of extending it, it might not have been able to take place next week, but when the minister put up July, the teacher made it clear that that was his preference. The teachers' union signed up to that initially. It changed. I think it would have been better. I think it would have been better for universities as well if the normal system had played. Equally,
what do you think happened there, Bertie?
Oh, you know, pressure and panic.
Pressure
and panic, and people were changing their minds.
You see, for somebody who said you think the government have done a great job, then gave a litany of all the ways that they didn't do a good job.
Well, I didn't get to the one that I think was the biggest mess of all, the nurses'
homes. Oh, God, go on.
The nursing home, were two-thirds. It'll end up about two-thirds of the people that died, died in nursing home. But I think they're learning things. I mean, if you roll back the tape now, Brendan, or go back to papers you've been following this week by week, at the start, everyone was talking about the ventilators, the respirators, the intensive care, the hospital beds, take over the private. And we were all into that.
Because we're not experts.
Yes.
We were watching footage from Italy.
And nobody had the finger on the nursing home. And I think that was the sad thing. And they will get the biggest blunt of it. Now, do I blame anyone for that? I think it's a lesson that we have to learn, a very tough lesson. But, you know, so I think they were doing their best, everyone. But there are things along the way, and it's no good. I don't think we should get into the argument just whether it's 1 meter or 2 meters. There are a whole lot. I'll tell you, if you ask me what scares me most, and I personally am scared about COVID-19 today, but I am worried about what happens in November. I'm worried about what happens when the airport opens up. I'm worried about when people start dawdling in from all over the world, from countries that haven't cared a damn about this, and there's plenty of them, let's not name them, where people start arriving and what's going to happen to those people? You know, nowadays, if you look at your app at Dublin Airport, there's hardly a plane out in the sky over it. But that's not going to be the case in a few months. And, you know, they're the things I'm far more worried about than today.
When you said there you're scared about COVID-19. Have you been very worried about getting it?
I'm not scared now. For the first 5 or 6 weeks, I didn't move from the house. I just about walked around the block. I didn't see the grandkids for 9 weeks or 8 weeks anyway. I had no visitors. I had one call to the house in 8 weeks. So, you know, I stuck to the rules absolutely rigid.
You've seen the grandkids again now, have you?
I've just seen the grandkids. And I just take Dermot's point. Two of my grandkids to make their confirmation, which of course went by the board. Not sure what will happen with that. This was their last few months in school. They were to go on to secondary school. They've missed that. Like, even to come back for a week, I think would have said goodbye to their friends because being in Dublin, they all go to different secondary schools. And their things, was that going to change the whole statistics?
But, we now appear to have agreed, have we not, that schools are not dangerous. It is safe to open the schools, but it's just going to take us apparently 2-3 months to get around it.
There is the question of the logistics of getting people to school and of parents and of teachers and, you know, the needs that they have in relation to what's going on their own homes. Like, it's not just about the fact that the young kids are not spreading COVID or don't have COVID. I mean, there is more around it, but you would like to think that it could be managed in some way. There are questions for the Department of Education to answer about the way in which it has managed this. And there was a lot of...
How did you manage the exams in third level?
It's easier at third level.
They just happened, didn't they?
No, nothing just happens. You know,
but you scrambled quickly and came up with a plan.
When I say it's easier at third level, you know, we're used to doing quite a lot of online business, you know, and a lot of, you know, the traditional sit-down exam, you know, we used to traipse down to the RDS when we were students in UCD, and there'd be hundreds of us in the big hall. A lot of those exams are gone now anyway. There's a lot of continuous assessment and end-of-term research papers, and that was easy enough to manage, you know. It was still exhausting trying to get everything over the line and switch everything online. That was, however,
You know, do you think the leaving cert should have happened at the end of July?
I do, yes. Yeah. I mean, my own belief at the time was that the Department of Education should have made a decision and stuck with it insofar as it could. But there was such pressure exerted. And I appreciate that the students were under enormous strain and there was uncertainty and there was fear. But I do think there could have been a serious mobilisation and an awful lot of voluntary effort to ensure that people who might normally be involved in the Leaving Cert process could have got involved in some way to try and ensure that it...
I know a lot of SNAs who would love to be doing something and who have offered to volunteer in all kinds of areas, and a lot of them saying they never heard back from anyone. Nora, you're shaking your head.
Just because I have a son who goes to the university that Dermot is a lecturer at, and he just finished all his exams, and he's not somebody who has done well under an exam system. Most kids are very anxious when it comes to exams. I personally think the Leaving Cert should have been scrapped years ago. Why would we ever want to test?
In an orderly fashion, with a plan.
I was just about to say that. Yeah. Not under these circumstances, but testing people, regurgitating information at speed is extremely stressful for young people. And here we have a situation where most households, I'm doing Zoom calls with business owners, I've met all their babies because they all pop in and out. We're in a huge experiment of parenting and homeschooling. These children are in households, not privileged ones. They often don't have Wi-Fi, don't have broadband, don't have access to a computer. They're under the most anxious time of their lifetime to date, and we're also saying, why don't you set the Leaving Cert? It's not about logistics. It's not about finding the right hall or about finding the right space. Testing people under those conditions on an exam that's already extremely stressful is incredibly difficult. Now, I have to say that it's down to individual lecturers, Dermot, as to whether it's a good experience doing online exams in real time. Like, he got 48 hours to do a lot of these exams. He found it extremely stressful. He's got severe asthma, so he's been cocooning since the beginning, didn't have access to a library. A lot of his colleagues really missed the human interaction. They didn't have the ability to talk to people on the phone. Most of the lecturers were hugely sympathetic. They gave lots of deadline extensions to people where they needed it. But nonetheless, they still had to pass their exams. They still had to do their essays under difficult circumstances. So look, for me, I'm just saying, look at South Korea. They, for 2 months now, no cases, opened the classrooms last week. On Friday they closed them because they've had the biggest spike in 2 months. And so we're all sitting here saying it's grand, our cases are low, the curve is nearly flattened. We've forgotten about the second wave. We've forgotten about the fact that we haven't got a vaccine.
Yeah, I'm not sure that those cases in South Korea came from a school. They came from
one particular area.
Yeah, they came from a factory or a facility.
Nonetheless, that could happen to us.
And from the bar area, which I think is
keeping on that theme of education, you know, it's imperative that they begin to plan for the next academic year now, so that they don't fall into the same traps, you know, and are reacting in the short term. They need to begin to think. And this raises this question, of course, it's not just about education, it's about health, it's about the economy. You know, is this going to be transformative, this crisis? Are we going to think completely differently about the way we assess people in education, about the way we work and about remote working?
Just before we move on, in terms of, from a historical perspective, and you see the big arc of things and everything, how do you see this? If you can't, history repeats itself. So if you be a little bit of a historian, a little bit of a futurologist, how do you see this fitting into the arc of the history of our lifetimes and how different everything is afterwards?
Well, I mean, we keep going back to the Great Spanish Flu, as it was erroneously termed from 1918 to 1919. What's frightening, I suppose, about that is that it was three waves. There were three waves across 1918 and 1919. And there are a lot of parallels between COVID
and how do you see it changing our society in reality?
I would be worried that an awful lot of the possibilities that we deem to be there now will not actually become reality, because there will be a clamour to recover, there'll be a clamour to return to normality, because people will crave a return as opposed to trying to make the most of some of the opportunities that have been created. And obviously I'd be thinking about that in relation to education.
People are going to say it's fine for you to talk about the opportunities, you're in a fine public sector job and everything. The people who are out there in small and medium businesses, people who've lost their jobs or been put on furlough or whatever, are not seeing the opportunities.
Oh, absolutely. And I take that point. And I mean, of course, it underlines the degree of job security that some people have and the insecurity that others have. But it has also been demonstrated that it is possible to do your business differently if there is sufficient support there. And this question that's going to come out of this crisis, the big state, what is the role of the big state? That's always been the question historically in relation to reacting to an emergency. Including,
are we going to see much bigger
emergency
government now, Bertie?
Yeah, I think government for the next few years, if you look at the Fiscal Council report this week and the SRI report, both of them are saying government are going to have to be far more involved for the next few years. They're going to have to spend more, not austerity. It's going to be trying to prime the economy, trying to get over the next 2 or 3 years. There will be a big load of debt on the other side of that.
How bad is the outlook, do you think?
Well, this year it'll be... If you look at the SRI report and the fiscal study report, it's between 8% and 15% of a cut in GDP, which is it's very hard doing a quick thought of the figures, and lunatics like me do that. But it's about 30 billion this year. We've accounted for probably half of that already. You're probably looking at an EBR, a debt EBR ratio again, of somewhere up around 80.
Okay, putting it in English, how many jobs will come back? How many will be lost?
I think a lot of your jobs will come back quick, but you're still looking at end of the year unemployment position of 17%, according to both those reports, which we went into this on St. Patrick's weekend, it was 4.8.
Okay, now the figure, a figure that we had in 1987 in and around that, and it was regarded as a calamity, as it was, of course, for the economy.
Yeah.
And what it led
and there
to,
were
course,
other countries
was a massive exodus.
Yeah.
Is that opportunity going to be there, if you want to call it that?
One of the countries, of course, they went to in their droves was our near neighbours in the UK. They are coming out of lockdown too in probably slightly different circumstances to us. Dennis, I put on your headphones there, guys, and I'm going to talk to Dennis Staunton, Irish Times London editor. Dennis, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
So, Dennis, if I was taking my view of things in the UK from the pictures in the Daily Mail website, I'm picturing you at Durdle Door Beach in Devon with your top off, showing your tattoos and drinking beer. Is that a fair summation of what's going on in the UK this weekend?
Not exactly of me, but but certainly there's, and you've had similar pictures from Brighton Beach and from various places. Now, I think that what you've seen is that it's a lovely sunny weekend here, as it is over there. The government already announced that from tomorrow you're going to be able to meet up to 6 people outdoors, either in a park or indeed in your back garden, if you like. And so people have kind of anticipated some of this loosening in their own behaviour. And you certainly see out in the park yesterday, even here in London, that there is a certain laxness. So I don't think it's quite as terrible as some of the pictures make it look. I mean, so often things look really particularly awful from a certain angle in a photograph. And actually, if you're there, people are a bit further apart than they appear to be in the picture. And I think most people are still staying some distance from one another, but they're not necessarily, they don't appear to be terrified of being too close together.
Dennis, I'm thinking back to that that piece that Matt Lucas did, the 18 funniest seconds of this whole pandemic, where he did Boris Johnson. Stay at home, don't stay at home, go to work. If you can go to work, don't go to work, stay at home, go to work. Is the messaging still a bit mixed over there?
Yeah, it is. And actually, for the last couple of weeks, really, even before, say, the whole Dominic Cummings business, I think a lot of people were, for example, already meeting in each other's gardens. And some of them knew that they weren't supposed to be doing it, but a lot of them thought that actually it was allowed. And so there is some confusion over what's going on. So, for example, on the Tube, if you go onto the London Underground, you see a sign and you hear these notices saying, is your journey really necessary? If it isn't, why don't you walk or take your bike? And then you'll see pictures all the time of people with masks and saying, please wear a face covering if social distancing is difficult. But then you go down and almost nobody's wearing a mask. And in the same way, in supermarkets, you had a short period where people appear to be wearing face coverings. Now, if you go in, it's really you're in a minority if you're like a very small minority if you're wearing one.
Okay.
So I think there is this, nobody's quite sure what the rules are. They know that things are loosening a bit. They know that there's a danger of a second spike. And at the same time, what you have is people on the one hand being kind of impatient to get back to normal because everybody's been driven mad by all this lockdown business, but on the other, they're afraid. And one of the reasons that the government has decided to take this step of allowing people to mix a bit more is to get them a bit more used to going out of their house.
And to banish this coronaphobia. Now, yeah. Speaking of that kind of fear coupled with a keenness to get out there, I was talking to Melanie C, the Spice Girl, yesterday, and she was talking about the prospect of her 11-year-old daughter going back to school tomorrow. And she said, on one hand, delighted for her, and on the other hand, very scared. So what are the schools all going to open tomorrow, or how is that working?
Well, the schools actually have been open throughout for children
NHS.
Of key workers and of people who and vulnerable children. But the interesting thing there is that only a small fraction of those entitled to go there went there. And what some schools will reopen, some will not. Many parents will not send their children to school. They just don't know how many will. And the government has made clear that they're not going to penalise anybody for keeping their kids at home. And so I think that, it's not just, so what you have is kind of junior infants, senior infants, and fifth class is opening.
Okay.
And then you have the nursery schools opening, but the nursery schools themselves say they don't even know exactly how they're supposed to do it because, they're, for example, supposed to keep the parents outside. And yet, if you're handing over a child who's maybe a bit afraid or hasn't been away from their family for a while, then how do you do that handover in such a way that it's totally socially distanced? So there are all kinds of things people just don't understand how they're going to do this.
Yeah, sorry, Dennis. I presume not helped by you had a number of key scientists have come out and said it's too early to be unlocking, haven't you?
You have, and the reason they've said that is because. Whatever about the R number, whether it's close to one or below one or whatever, the fact is there's still quite a lot of new infections, about 8,000 new infections a day. And so what some of the scientists who have been advising the government are saying is it's just too high. There are too many of them. And at the same time, what you haven't got is this testing and contact tracing system fully in place. It launched on Thursday, but it's quite clear that the contact tracers are not really up and running. Many of them say they can't log into the system. The woman, Dido Harding, who's in charge of it, says it won't really be fully operational until the end of June. And so there is this anxiety that you're going into this unlocking of the lockdown without exactly knowing that you've got a fully functioning surveillance system. And so if, say, there's an outbreak somewhere, you can clamp down on it.
Okay, the other big story of the week was, of course, the whole Dominic Cummings affair. Now, is that still rumbling on and is it still a problem, or has Boris successfully told people to move on?
I think it's over in the sense that unless something new emerges, Boris Johnson is keeping Dominic Cummings and Dominic Cummings is staying where he is. It's not over politically because it's come at a huge political cost to Boris Johnson. His own personal approval ratings have gone down 20%. It's now negative. The Conservative Party ratings have gone down in the polls. And meanwhile, you've got in Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, somebody that people like, and so his ratings have been going up. And the other problem you have is the Conservative backbenchers. And the reason that you had so many Conservative backbenchers coming out publicly asking for Cummings to go is because not only did they get an awful lot of emails, but it was the type of emails they were getting and the kind of people who were writing them. They were not the sort of people who are always writing to their MPs. And a lot of these messages they were getting were from usually older people, say people over 50, whose parents, if they're still alive, are old, and or else older people who couldn't see their grandchildren. And they were describing in detail the suffering they themselves had gone through because they had obeyed the rules.
And Dennis, has this pointed up? I see Tim Shipman in the Sunday Times today saying this affair has flushed out the degree to which Johnson is still leaning on others after his brush with the coronavirus. Talks about him being tired, irritable and struggling with detail in appearances. Has this made it look as if Johnson has not recovered and really needs Cummings too much?
Yes, well, I mean, you do hear that quite a lot from people around the government and inside Downing Street, that he really, he went back to work 10 days after coming out of intensive care, and that he isn't very much himself. And so, and also just this kind of forgetfulness, and he simply isn't kind of fully up to scratch, and actually that in other circumstances he'd probably take a big long holiday.
Yeah,
so he's depending on other people, but he's also, of course, totally dependent on Dominic Cummings and the Vote Leave crowd, because they really are the vision of his government. They're the people who know what his government is for, what they're supposed to do with the post-Brexit Britain.
OK. Bertie Ahern, what was your view on the Cummings thing?
Well, he's obviously very important, and we all know that. He's been around for several years. But he is a guy, you know, he believes that the rules of basic mortals don't really apply to him anyway. I mean, that's something he's followed all along. David Cameron called him names. Senior civil servants called him names. He is a person who has his own view of the world. Dermot would probably, his big fan in the world is Bismarck. I don't know enough about Bismarck, but he has his vision that there's a certain type of person with a high IQ is more superior to than the rest of us. And person he is.
So it's very dangerous that he now appears to be the guy that the Prime Minister is completely dependent on, in your view.
It is, because normally, you know, in government you have advisors, but you have a few, first of all. You don't have anyone that has that strength. And he's rubbed a lot of people the long way. My own view, he won't. He's not going to last the test of time.
And Johnson, will he last the test of time? What's your view on him?
Johnson will. I mean, he is an 87-seat majority. If he had a disastrous election in 5 years' time, he'd still be Prime Minister. So he's going to be around for the 2020s. And but I do agree, watching his press conference and watching last year and watching for years when he was mayor, he strikes you, I'm no doctor, but he strikes you as a guy that isn't in the whole of his health. The other day, I think the press conference, he clearly struggled for breath.
And we know now that people can be breathless and weak for months, and ICU as well leaves a big impact on
so
people.
So you didn't have to be a medic to see that.
Bertie, can I just Jeremy, I want to ask Bertie one more thing. Leo Varadkar seems to be able to do business with Johnson, and they seem to kind of rub up well. Would he be the kind of guy you could see yourself doing business with, or how would you do business with him?
Yeah, I think Johnson is not the most difficult guy to do business with, because he will switch his position to make a deal. He'll always be looking for
something you've been accused of yourself.
Sure. And you know, he's a guy who will look for solutions rather than a guy who looks for problems. I'd be interested, but if Dennis is still on the line, this week is a crucial week, because this is the last negotiating session of Brexit. If there's not progress on Brexit this week, the withdrawal agreement says at the end of June. That you have to have it. If you don't, you go into the autumn with a no deal. And the big thing, which I think is missed a lot, if you go into the autumn with no agreement, then you'd have to come back and go back to every individual country to see if you have an extension. And the issue this week is as simple as this. Is there going to be an extension beyond the 31st December? Is there not?
Dennis, what's your view?
I think there won't be. And I don't think anybody in Downing Street or indeed in Brussels thinks there will be. The government in Downing Street, their view of it is that, first of all, they don't like the idea of an extension. They think it's weak. It's like Theresa May. And that actually also they think that the Europeans understand deadlines. And they also think, for example, I mean, Bertie was saying that that Johnson can change his position. The backstop is a good example of that. Last October, as far as we saw it, Johnson accepted a Northern Ireland-only backstop, basically. But as far as Downing Street is concerned, this was a great victory for British diplomacy, and the Europeans backed down because the British were tough. So they won't do it for that reason. The other reason they don't want to do it is that they think that after the coronavirus, the Europeans are going to be expanding their budget, they're going to be spending a lot of money. Britain, if they stay in a transition period, will have to pay into that budget without being present for any of these decisions.
So are we looking at a no-deal Brexit, Dennis?
Well, what you're looking at, I think, and again, it's quite interesting, because if you speak to people in Downing Street and in the Commission, they both think the other side wants a deal. But I think what you could have is, I think there won't be any progress next week, and I think that you'll go into then September and October, and what you could have is a deal. Not a very good one, probably, for either side, necessarily. But you have a deal coming up to the deadline. But, you know, or else you just have no deal. And again, what Downing Street thinks is that actually what they're looking for is not all that different from no deal, so they could cope with that. And they also think that because there's so much disruption from the coronavirus, that actually another bit of disruption from a no-deal arrangement wouldn't be so bad. I'm not sure they'll
feel
that same way.
That's one way of looking at it. You could look at it that we've got this bloody coronavirus to deal with, so let's not add to our problems by having a crash-out Brexit, but yeah.
Yeah, and they might think that, actually, because you know, I mean, the thing is...
Do you think it's going to pan out?
Well, I think, if you put it simply, if there's no deal by the 30th of June, and I agree with Dennis, it doesn't look like it, you go to the autumn, and under the withdrawal agreement, you can't have an extension in the autumn without going back to all 27 countries. That would be very cumbersome. So I'm afraid the stakes on a no deal will be based a lot on what happens this week.
OK. Dermot?
Well, I mean, the last couple of weeks have really exposed a pathetic dependency on Dominic Cummings and a very weak British Prime Minister. I always think the talk of the abilities of Boris Johnson have been gloriously exaggerated anyway. I think he's very, very limited. And he struck me as someone who had an emphatic general election victory on the back of people being really fed up with Brexit. And he had the mantra that worked. What I would worry about is that this Cummings affair is going to have serious consequences for Ireland, because a much weakened Boris Johnson is going to be looking for a rallying point in relation to what's coming over the next couple
of months. So this is his war.
So this will be another opportunity to revert to the mantra about Britain going it alone and resisting this madness from Europe. And again, there'll be another assertion that the border on this island question is some kind of trivial irrelevance. You know, there'll be that willful ignorance that we've seen such evidence over the last couple of years.
Nora.
And again, that'll have serious consequences.
Two things I'd say. One is the issue of the border before the pandemic was something that's quite different to our conversations now about borders. And, you know, I'm probably not the only one who believes we shouldn't be in a travel bubble with the UK, whatever the leadership is. I worked with Boris Johnson for my last year in London. He is a very able and very intelligent man, whatever he portrays to the media, and he does not rely on anybody. But as somebody, my brother had COVID, he's still breathless. So a good friend of mine had COVID, she lost a stone in weight in a week. So we forget that in amongst all of this, there were serious health repercussions following COVID. The only thing that worries me, because of the transition arrangements, they got 20 billion signed off by the EU for SME supports. I hope we're going to talk about SMEs shortly.
Yeah.
So it would be very unfair in Europe if we were faced with a near neighbour who had, you know, potentially better benefits for SMEs and it unlevelled the playing fields for us.
OK. Guys, I have to take a break. Dennis Daunton, thank you very much. And Bertie Hearn, Nora Casey and Dermot Ferret are still with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Our panel's still here, Bertie Hearn, Nora Casey and Dermot Ferreter. And there are two other things that I want to discuss. Nora, we will get to SMEs in just a second. But there are the government formation is hotting up or cooling down, depending on your view. Hugh O'Connell in the Sunday Indo today writing about slipping deadlines. Fine Gael, some people in Fine Gael desperate for the talks to collapse. Fianna Fáil, on the other hand, desperate to get into government. Kevin Cunningham, Bertie, has a piece in the Sunday Indo, and he's basically saying that Fine Gael currently have a corona bounce, he's calling it. They're 20% ahead of Fianna Fáil, and that they are the ones with the power to walk away. A lot of mutterings about an election in September. Where do you think this is going?
I think there will, in the next 2 weeks, or maybe three, I don't think we've gone on 4 months, I don't think a week or two is going to make much difference. And as I said earlier, I think the government are handling things well through the problems of the last few months. So I think they will form a government. I think the Greens, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. Personally, I'd like to see a group of the rural independents in the mix in some form, either part of or supporting that government, because I think that's where a lot of the difficulties were. But I've, from what I know of the talks, which isn't a lot other than what I read, but some good articles today on it, like Hugh O'Connell's argument, that they will finalise a deal shortly.
You think Fine Gael want this government?
Well, I'm not sure any of them want it.
Yeah.
There
seems to be general agreement that Micheál Martin wants to be Taoiseach.
Yeah,
would you agree with that?
Will you
be glad to see him
get it? I will. He deserves a shot. It's 25 years ago since I appointed him to the front bench. It's a long time ago. So, yeah. No, he deserves a slot and I think he's going to get it.
And do you think he'd be a good Taoiseach?
I think he will. I mean, he's a lot.
Is he the man for the time?
He's been around for for a lot of departments and a lot of areas, a lot of expertise. Now, I think that the life of the next government, one, I think if the negotiators, I hope, are up to a 4-5 year term, because
that's what we're promised, isn't it?
Yeah,
stable,
I
long-term
think
government.
It should be stable, because that's what's necessary. And I think the first half it is going to be maybe the easier half, because what I said earlier on, you're going to be priming the economy, you're going to be putting money in. You might need the Europe 750 million if you want the 500 in grants, or the 250 in loans. If they go down that road, maybe they just go to the markets. We're in a good position. So the second half is going to have the correction. So I think
don't call it austerity. We'll call it a correction.
Yeah. The correction, but it's going to be, if ESRI and the fiscal council are going to be advising the next government, they say that correction is going to be in the order of 25-30 million, which is a health side lower than what it was after the crash. So it's not impossible. But you do need a government that will see both parts of it through.
And I think
that will happen. And I don't think it's in any...
Fianna Fáil there for the good bit and Fine Gael there then for
the correction. They're going to have to stay for...
But Micheál Martin there for the good bit.
But they would also have to get any agreement past their members. And the Green Party certainly would be facing a very long night of the soul. If you consider the Green Party are needed and they're wanted... Mm-hmm. They would seem to be in quite a strong position, and they should, of course, be using that leverage that they have. But we also know that the party is going to be completely divided, as it has been historically, on whether or not it should enter coalition government.
Yeah. Who is the man or woman for the time, Dermot Farrator, do you think?
Well, Eamon Ryan has been there for a long time. I remember watching Eamon Ryan in 2011 outside UCD taking down his posters up a ladder, and I felt sorry for him, because it seemed to me they made the right decision. You know, this had always been a debate, supposedly between the fundos and the realos in the Green Party, about whether or not they could compromise and go into government. And they gave it a shot and obviously got hammered, mostly because of circumstances you could argue outside of their control. But the question is, you know, does Eamon Ryan want different things than the bulk of the party membership? And if you're setting the bar as high as 2/3 of the membership have to approve this, it's going to be very difficult, and it's going to be very divisive, and you're going to be brought back to that debate that was there within the Green Party in 2007 and before. And again, that wasn't just a question for the Irish Greens, it was a question for the Greens internationally. Mm-hmm. About how they were able to use the new political capital that they were accumulating. And that issue has been by no means resolved. But you would like to see the Green Party being strong, being disciplined, and maximising their advantage at the moment. I don't think they're doing that.
And given that the stimulus that Europe is going to give us is going to be, it's going to be a green-led recovery, so we're led to believe. So you would imagine it's a good time for the Greens to
but
be.
But also, I don't like to interrupt. It's just not a natural thing for me to do. But I feel if we've learned something over the last period of time, we've learned that, you know, there is a diminished role for politicians in the future, and that we would rely more heavily on expert panels to try and get us through the next phase. We've just relied hugely on, as you say, Tony Holohan and his team. So if you look at elderly care, people are going around saying it's not a blame game. Of course it's not a blame game, but we need to fix it, and it needs to be resolved quickly. We have a 29-page document on return to work, everything from bringing your biro to sign in at security, but nothing about how are we going to fix the fact that the cities are jammed with people who have to come into a workplace, which could be 3,000 or 4,000 people in an office block. How do we set up an expert panel to say that doesn't have to happen? We can have satellites all over the country. People don't have to drive 200,000 people driving 4 hours or more to work every day. It's not really about which politician is sitting in that hot seat. It's more for me about the fact, how do they get around them? Some serious experts that can look at these areas. SMEs, I know we're going to talk about in a minute, but it's a classic case where unless you understand that SME sector, unless you truly understand what that business owner is going through, you cannot possibly come up with the supports.
Okay, we're now talking about SMEs,
okay,
Nora. Do you think they don't understand?
Okay, so our near neighbour has 20 billion. We've just over a billion, and a lot of that has been repackaged from Brexit, actually. In the early days, I was downloading forms for SMEs that I'm helping, and it had Brexit written at the top of the form. So most owners, they don't really want you to lift all of the restrictions all at once, because they're not ready yet. They're all trying to figure out how to make their workplaces safe.
And a lot of them seem to be saying they're not getting the advice they need.
Okay.
There's no one to go and talk to about the granular detail of how they're allowed
to
open.
Two things, Brennan. I'm working with about 14 SMEs at the moment, some of them B2B, as in business to business, some of them on the high street, retailers that you might know. The pandemic subsidy schemes are really complicated. You know, you have to go on and look at 20 or 30 different, from Microfinance Ireland to the local enterprise office to Enterprise Ireland to Strategic Banking Corporation. So very complicated. Most of my life is trying to unravel all that red tape, help them through how to ask for loans. At the end of the day, the banks are the ones that are giving them the loans and they're very risk averse. So they've always been risk averse. It doesn't really matter how often the government says we've got 1 billion of supports available. At the end of the day, if one of the banks is the one that's signing off, they're going to be looking at the viability of that business rather than whether the economy needs it.
Okay, so now you have about a minute.
What do we need to do with the banks? Unlike other leaders in the country, business leaders who talked about people on wage subsidy scheme, we need to be extending that. We also need to be giving that pandemic salary support to SMEs much longer. I mean, already you're seeing a penal attitude happening. If you don't want to go to work, we're going to rip that off you. You know, if you're opening up your business, we'll take the subsidy. We should be doing a 6 month to 12 month plan on supporting businesses, because at the end of the day, you just talked about how many employees are going to lose their jobs. That's the SME sector in the country.
Okay, so where's the expert panel on that? Can we afford to support all these businesses?
No, not everybody will come back. There's almost certainly, you know, there's hundreds of news agents have closed, mom and pop stores. Maybe they won't come back. They were cocooning. Maybe they're ill. Anything could have happened in that area. The high street will change. Maybe more artisan shops. You know, we're all happy to do the big long queue for the pandemic shop. But because we're not in restaurants and we're not treating ourselves on holidays, we might like some artisan butchers, bakers. That would be lovely to see something like that happening.
The whole of Dublin would be like Stony Batter or Williamsburg or whatever. Yeah,
but you know,
it sounds great for the well-heeled middle classes anyway.
But
certainly,
my only
it?
Point overall is, yeah. I am really pleased that I lived through this pandemic, because I've done things I've never done before. I've started cycling. I've started walking. Eons of operation transformations and nutritionists have never affected the change that this has had on people in Ireland. We've had a time to pause. Has the government in the pause, you know, discovered anything about what they could do in the future to bring experts on board? Has businesses had enough time to pause? I don't want us galloping back into the workplace without stopping and thinking, could we be a better country? Could we be leaders in this particular area of not necessarily forcing people to go into the workplace, doing things like telemedicine to the nth degree, and online learning through universities and schools?
Okay, Nora Casey, thank you very much for that. Nora, stay with us. And Bertie Ahern and Dermot Ferrer, will you stay with us as well? And now, just after 12 noon, I'll go to the newsroom and Suzanne Lynch. And the news, Susan Jackson, I beg your pardon.